The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Scott, welcome back. How does it feel to be a, I don't want to say new dad, a renewed dad?
A renewed dad? We need to put that on a t-shirt. I don't know how we could pop this
up. It just sounds like you're a nude dad, though. That's the problem, which is not what you want.
Not what you're going for this week, at least. We'll see. I'm good. I'm very sleep deprived, but not like definitely not twice as sleep deprived as I was before. So I think that's a win right there. This is definitely...
But like you didn't have an extra sleep deprived unit of capacity. Like, yeah, you're right. Like it's not twice as bad. It's like 1.4 times as bad. But I was already really tired when I had my second kid. I didn't have an extra 0.4 unit of capacity.
I didn't think I did. I think I must. I appear to be surviving. I did foolishly agree to give a talk like 2 weeks into having a baby, which was the stupidest thing I've done because I was
so
sleep deprived.
How angry is your wife about that?
Out of it. She signed off in advance. Oh. But I was like, just so struggling. The only way I had confidence that I could actually like deliver anything was to write it all out in advance, meaning it was terrible and way too long. Ended up getting cut off like halfway through anyway. I was like, all right, this may have been a poor set of decisions I've made here. But you know, it's life. What are you going to do? I'm a hashtag girl dad now. So I get a lot of points for that, I think, on the interwebs, as far as I can tell. I'm a father of a daughter. Finally, I can use that in my campaign speech to excuse my draconian conservative social policy like I've been hoping to do all this time. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Rational Security. I am, yes, it is me, your co-host, one of your co-hosts, now returned, Scott R. Anderson. Thrilled to be back here with you after a few weeks gone, and thrilled to be back with my two other co-hosts in our virtual studio, Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
And Alan Rosenstein.
All hail the renewed father.
I'm thrilled to see that the Rational Security Clubhouse remains standing. There is no,
it's
not burned down.
There were some close calls. We are worse at this than you are.
I was worried that there was a no Scott sign going to be hung outside and you would recruited one single other Scott to join the podcast in my absence, which would have been devastating.
Jokes aside, by far the hardest thing in your absence, and Quinta, I think, will back me up on this, is the puns. You're like a savant. Man, it took so much time.
I just gave up.
Yeah, Quinta gave up. I tried, and I think I did like okay, but you are so much better at this than the rest of us. It's
I think
wild.
I've said this before. The secret is I only give myself 30 minutes to do it before we record. And so it's just complete terror that drives, which is why every once in a while, there's a real miss. But you know, when you're that terrified, it really sharpens the senses, and including your sense of punnery. Well, I am thrilled to be back here, not quite off of family leave, because I'm technically on family leave for just about everything else. But I thought I'd come back to Rational Security a few weeks earlier. So in all of that, I'm thrilled to be back here for what I am calling the Don't Call It a Comeback, because I'm technically still on leave edition of the podcast. So please don't tell anyone else at Lawfare or Brookings or anyone else that I'm doing it work again. I'm not. But I'm happy to be back here on Rational Security to talk through this week's big national security news, including topic one, first is the worst. The historic first criminal trial of a former president has commenced in New York state courts. Both sides have sketched out their cases and opening arguments, and we've already had a hearing on whether former President Trump should be held in contempt. But what will the charges being brought against him related to alleged hush money payments on his behalf mean for him and for his 2024 presidential prospects? Topic two, fair weather, friend. After months of delay that have, by some accounts, pushed Ukraine dangerously close to defeat, the House has finally passed legislation that will provide them with essential foreign assistance alongside other aid packages for Israel and Taiwan, as well as a handful of related foreign affairs measures. What is good, bad, and ugly about the package that finally got through, and what do the dynamics of its passage mean for other U.S. foreign policy interests in the near term? And topic three, the clock is talking. Among the side measures passed.
It could have been ticking. It could have been tick-tocking. Why talking?
For whom the tick tocks?
For whom the talk ticks.
For whom the talk ticks. Yeah.
Titles. This is the reason we're going to be keep coming back to this topic over and over again.
Bite Dance gets bitten. There's like a whole Bite Dance set of puns. There's a lot of good stuff. Yeah.
Biting the hand that dances you? I don't know. Ooh, there's something there. We'll get
that's
there.
That's actually really
good. Let's not ruin them all. We do this too often. I have to come up with these every week in 30 minutes. So let's hold back. Among the side measures passed by the House and likely be enacted into law is a bill targeting the popular social media platform TikTok, one that would ban that platform if its owners ByteDance do not divest due to concerns with the degree of control the Chinese government may have over it. But is this sort of regulation of a social media platform constitutional, and is banning it good policy? For our first topic, Alan, let me hand it over to you to get us started.
Oh, man, so much to talk about. So first, I should note, because this is literally a developing story, because testimony is literally happening, I think, right now. Although maybe it's ended already.
I think it just ended.
It ended at two for Passover.
I still think in Central Time. That's my problem. I'm just a country boy in Minnesota. But I should say, so we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, right after testimony has ended. I think court is off Wednesday, and so it'll be back on when you all hear this on Thursday. And I just want to plug, Lawfare is doing a massive amount of coverage on this. We have, you know, daily reports. We have a really great quick live stream after each day session. So, you know, if you really want the in-depth, we have a whole apparatus going on.
Can I give an official shout out, having really spent just the last 48 hours digging into this? Tyler McBrien, our managing editor, is like a Twitter thread savant. We have very good Twitter threaders. He's so good. It's like complete sentences, perfectly well written. It's like a book. You could just copy and paste it. And then he has little observations and little like links to collateral sources in real time somehow. I have no idea how he's doing it. It's amazing. It's one of the best things I've read. It is the best thing I'm reading on the trial. So I highly recommend that. And big shout out for Spicy Tyler for his amazing work. It's just phenomenal.
It's really good. My favorite is, I think at some point someone said, I met Michael Cohen at a bar mitzvah, and I think Tyler's tweet was, I think I've definitely said that, though, about a different Michael Cohen and a different bar mitzvah. Just like such a good joke, right?
It's so good. It's
just
so
in the middle of a Twitter thread. Okay, so obviously we're talking about the hush money trial. As Scott mentioned, we had jury selection last week. We have a jury. We had opening statements on Monday. We had the testimony of David Pecker, the head of amazing name, by the way, just amazing name for this trial, of the National Enquirer, and a contempt hearing this morning, though sadly not a ruling from the bench, which is what I was really hoping for. And not a contempt hearing about Donald Trump's extramural speech, during which Trump then also truthed an insane thing. This trial is amazing. So much to talk about. And I'll start with you, Quinta. Let's just start with the kind of opening statements, because that, I think, is probably the most important thing so far, because that gives us a blueprint for what each of the sides is going to argue. So what, if anything, did we learn now that the state finally has to make its case and defendant Trump has to sort of articulate his theory?
I do think we learned a fair amount during opening statements, both from the DA's office. So Matthew Colangelo was arguing for the DA. And then on Trump's side, we had the one, the only Todd Blanche, who is somehow managing like 3 out of 4 of these criminal trials and somehow still appears to be, you know, waking up every morning and doing it all over again.
Is he the guy with like the boots? With the fancy
boots?
He
is not the guy with the boots. The guy with the boots is in Georgia, okay. Which is the trial that Blanche is not in charge of. So I think we learned a fair amount in terms of how the DA's office is planning on presenting the case, the story that they're telling. And the reason that that's important is that this requires a lot of explanation, so please bear with me. Essentially, Trump has been charged with what's called first-degree falsification of business records, which is second-degree falsification of business records, meaning you falsified a business record, plus done with an intent to commit or aid in the commission of or conceal the commission of another crime. That's what makes it a felony. The question then is, okay, so what, you know, how are we getting to that felony? What's the other crime there? And Bragg had set out a number of different options and court filings over the course of the last few months. But there had been questions about just how he was going to frame the case, which of these offenses or which of these crimes that he's alleging Trump intended to commit, he was going to kind of focus the narrative around. And that, I think, led to some sort of uncertainty in terms of just how the DA was going to present this case. So in Colangelo's opening, he started very directly saying, and I'll just quote him here, this case is about a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up. And the conspiracy he's alleging here is a conspiracy between Trump, Michael Cohen, his fixer, and David Pecker at American Media, so the National Enquirer, basically agreeing that the National Enquirer is going to help Trump out during the campaign. That leaning on that conspiracy argument is important because that tells us what that sort of additional charge that's stepping the business records charge up to a felony is that they're building the story around. And that is New York election law. It's 17-152, which makes it unlawful to, and I quote, conspire to promote or prevent the election of any person to a public office by unlawful means. So the fact that Colangelo kept saying, you know, conspiracy, 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 that means he's talking about this New York election law. That does leave this additional question, okay, if you're conspiring to promote the election via unlawful means, what are those unlawful means? There's kind of a third step here, so to speak. And Colangelo gave us some more details on that as well, that the unlawful means in question has to do with unlawful campaign contributions. So that's a reference to violations of federal campaign finance law. The somewhat unfortunate acronym is FECA, F-E-C-A, and as well as tax fraud and falsification of business records on AMI's side. So basically, they were fudging what they were doing to cover it up in their internal records as well. Again, all of that had been present in the court documents, but I think seeing it set out that way directly kind of helps clarify just what parts of the story the DA's office is emphasizing, how they're kind of stringing it together into a narrative for the jury. And then Todd Blanche's response was really interesting because there had been a lot of suggestion that he was basically going to be arguing, oh, you know, this didn't have anything to do with, you know, the election. This was just because, you know, Trump just wanted to cover this up to save Melania's feelings because the allegation is that he'd had this relationship while she was pregnant, that he'd been having this extramarital activity, so to speak. And Blanche basically didn't touch that at all. He essentially was like, yep, you know what? Everyone does it. It's nothing unusual about this. It's not criminal. I don't have the line in front of me, but he essentially said it's not an unlawful conspiracy to influence the election. That's just democracy. I don't have the fine points of his argument in front of me in the same way I do for Colangelo, so I don't want to shortchange it. But it was pretty striking to me how that was kind of the way that he chose to frame it.
So let me ask you a kind of follow-up question, Quinta. You know, in a trial, in any trial, there are some questions for the judge to decide, questions of law and figuring out the jury instructions. And then there's questions for the jury to decide, primarily questions of fact. Now, I'm not sort of as fully steeped in the details of this trial as you are, but it seems odd to me that the defense would be, yes, even if we did all the things that, you know, the prosecutors alleging that we did, it's not a crime. But that's not something the jury can decide, right? Isn't the judge that going to tell the jury, hey, here's what the elements of the crime are, and then the jury's going to decide. But so doesn't Trump need, in fact, to establish that he did this not to affect an election, but to protect his marriage? I'm missing something here.
No, it's a great question, and I don't actually know. I do think that the elements of the law here, like the division between what is and isn't for the jury to decide, is a bit confusing because in order to In order to get to the step up, you need the New York election crime. In order to have the New York election crime, you need the FICA violation. So it does seem like there's an element of like the jury needs to decide whether there was a FICA violation, which is to some extent a question of law, right? So it gets a little tangled in that sense.
But I would assume the judge will tell the jury what constitutes a FICA violation. Like what set of facts would constitute
one would expect, yes.
But the jury will have to make a factual finding on Trump's state of mind and intent.
Yes.
That's what this all goes to. Because he has to have the intent to cover up a election-related criminal offense. And so he's saying here, my intent wasn't really to do any of this. And by the way, arguing the alternative, this wouldn't even be an election offense. Because this is just shaping the media landscape, which is an accepted electoral practice. And that's even if they concede, yeah, we made these payments and we doctored these records, or didn't doctor, we represented it this way in these records, but not with any intent to deceive any election official, right? That this is just the way we ended up recording and structuring. It's because we did think of this as legal services, things like that.
Right.
They're muddying up the facts a little bit, but a lot of the facts in dispute is about state of mind. It's not about the actual conduct, I think.
So to clarify, so they are saying the records were not falsified. And the reasoning there is that, and to be clear, we're talking here just about the Trump Organization records, not the AMI records, which is a different issue. But the argument, as Blanche set it out, was essentially, oh no, Cohen was on retainer. So the records that were falsified essentially were that Cohen paid Daniels, Stormy Daniels, in order to get paid back, he submitted invoices to Trump that were labeled for his legal services, which the Trump Organization then listed as paying him for being on retainer. And so those are the false business records. Cohen's invoices, the internal records in the Trump Organization, and then the checks that were cut. And part of Blanche's argument, as I understood it, was that, you know, oh, Cohen was on retainer, right? So there's nothing falsified here. Because there's not, you know, that's what these payments were about. And so once you kind of pull that rug out, you don't need to get to the FICA issue, although I'm sure that they will touch on that.
I think that's a good summary of where the case is now. Although one quick note, I think that the government did argue that the step up can be based independently as well, not just on the New York State provision, but on the federal law provision.
Yes, that's correct.
Law. Yeah. In addition to seeing those as like they're all awkwardly tied together because each of the statutes refers back to these other events in this strange.
I will say I had to draw a flowchart to get myself to understand. Flowcharts
are very popular, Quinta, up for auction right now. So yeah. Let's get that up on that eBay.
Exactly.
So, you know, what I'll say is like, I think right now the significance of this case, it's worth stepping back because I think prosecution's going to matter, conviction's going to matter. But there's a lot that could matter and is going to matter in the weeks before we get to any sort of resolution in this case so far, into the optics that feeds into kind of the political sense and the perception of Donald Trump. The first is that, you know, this is, I think as Quinta has noted and other folks have noted, like the trial environment's an awkward one for Trump. It is one where he does not have control. He does not have a friendly atmosphere and where he is being put on display and being forced to talk about things within the limits of the Fifth Amendment and things like that, but often forced or at least strongly incentivized to talk about things that are awkward for him to talk about. You have nothing else. Lots of other people are talking about things that are very awkward for him. And this case really brings that to the fore. Like, this is not the most serious legal crime he's been charged with. It's probably the least significant, frankly. But it deals with some of his skeeviest conduct, like allegedly cheating on his wife and allegedly paying a bunch of people to get out from doing it, right? Like, that's bad conduct. People don't like that. Yeah, we all kind of suspect it was happening for a long time anyway, but I think it's awkward for him to talk about and awkward to have all this stuff brought back to the fore. It's awkward enough that Donald Trump paid several $100,000 to keep it from happening in 2016. Probably not great that that's happening now, at least allegedly paid that money, right? And the other aspect of this is just Trump's inability to control himself. When we saw that on display today, right, where he's having a contempt hearing where they're actively debating certain truths he truthed, if you will, to use the parlance of the times, out to put out there. And as they're reading them out, he's actively saying something else critical of the judge, not technically in violation of the actual like gag order that he was subject to, but still really problematic, and outright saying the judge should recuse himself because he's biased against me when he hasn't even ruled on the matter yet. Like, it is so self-defeating and awkward. It's a bold choice, except that for Trump, for him, the importance is that he convinces his people who like him and agree with him that this is a great injustice. And the question is, how effective is that narrative sell in an environment where you need to expand a voter base, right? Or you need to win over at least some swing voters to win. And that's always the question with him, is like, how much does his appeal to the base pull away from potential appeal to swing voters? And I think on both of those fronts, like, this is a problematic environment for him to be operating on. Am I being too rose-colored glasses about this, Quintal?
No, I don't think so. And I also think it's worth emphasizing, and this is something I wrote about in The Atlantic earlier this week, that the trial is about Stormy Daniels, but it's really about the Access Hollywood tape. And what I mean by that is that key to Bragg's story of the case is that Trump was frantic to prevent Daniels from coming forward with her story about their interaction because the Access Hollywood tape had just dropped and he was terrified about his vulnerabilities with female voters. So prosecutors will be able to introduce a transcript of the tape into evidence. Merchan has ruled that they can't actually play the tape. He doesn't want them to hear Trump's voice. But this touches on one of the real hot button issues in 2016. And one of the things that seemed like it might really lose Trump support. Now, in the end, of course, he won anyway. And I would argue that the sort of sublimated frustration from that is part of what got us here to begin with in terms of the long, long road that goes to Me Too and then Stormy Daniels coming forward and now this trial. But I don't think it is helpful for him to be putting on the table once again that memory of the Access Hollywood tape. It's not something that is part of his appeal, except for probably a very, very small group of people who are going to vote for him anyway. So I just don't think that that's particularly helpful to him in making his case.
So I agree with everything. And just to add another point that I haven't sort of heard discussed a lot, which is, you know, if you imagine that this trial happened 30 years ago, like in the 90s, you would expect that part of Trump's strategy would be to try to sort of discredit Stormy Daniels because she's an adult film star and that's immoral and, you know, whatever stereotype about loose women and stuff like that. And that he would try to sort of use that to deflect. And I think it's an interesting sign of the times and sort of the recognition that, you know, sex work is a legitimate thing and these people are people, you know, whether or not they're doing sex work. Is that I don't think, like, it's pretty clear he's not going to be able to get away with that, and it's not really playing any part in the conversation. Now, he will try to discredit Stormy Daniels in the way that he would any sort of witness, but you know, I do think that he's not going to get a free pass just because, you know, one of the key players here is engaged in a profession that, you know, 30 years ago would have been considered one of sort of low morals and ill repute. And I do think that is just, again, to your point, Quinta, about Me Too and how these perceptions have changed. I think that's a kind of good thing about our society.
Well, this is, I'm going to spoil my object lesson, which is there's a great documentary that just came out that's called Stormy, that's available on Peacock, that's about Daniels and her career and sort of what her life has been like since all of this happened. And one of the things that I found really, really interesting is that she talks about basically, so she does this like nightclub tour after coming forward about what happened to her with Trump on the grounds that basically she has an opportunity to make a lot of money. And that the crowd at the clubs that she's dancing at basically changes from the normal clientele, i.e. men to, or straight men to like a lot of gay men and a lot of older women who like want to come up to her and say like, I respect you. Thank you for what you're doing, which is just like a beautiful little snapshot of America in the year 2018, 2019. And I think does speak to how, as you say, Alan, like that ability to sort of discredit her is limited because of the changing social context.
I do think there's one other angle we're going to see Trump argue where he's actually going to have some hooks on the political front. I don't think it legally matters that much, which is this point about the fact that he claims, has claimed already, and I suspect we're going to see this reiterated, particularly in the political sphere again, that he made these payments even though the stories were foundationally untrue. Now, we think the story of Daniel story is probably true. I find it fairly credible. Karen McDougall, like other stories as well, like fairly credible stories. But the kind of lead story, the story that is often cited as kicking off this relationship, and was, I think, the first one of these stories I brought up in testimony with David Pecker today, was about this allegation from a Trump Tower staffer that Trump had fathered an illegitimate child that the National Enquirer actually did investigate. I think even put the individual in question under a polygraph, and then determined the story. They did not believe the story was true, and nonetheless, they did actually pay for some expense to kind of capture and kill it. A much lower amount, and it's kind of a problematic environment. But I think, I suspect this is going to be part of the narrative we're going to come out here, is that we're going to hear all this talk about this stuff, and Trump is going to say, none of this is true. I captured and killed these stories when, even when I didn't think it was true. And the truth is, he did. And that does make a little bit of a muddier picture. And I think that's a thread we're going to see supporters of former President Trump maybe hold on to say, yeah, they're talking about this conduct, but still just slander. These are just stories out there that he didn't want to have to deal with. And even if they weren't true, he killed them. There are counterarguments, including the sheer amount of money paid and not to mention the corroborating evidence on these stories. But I think that's still going to be, I don't think there's any resolution as to the veracity of these stories coming out.
But that doesn't matter for the underlying charges at all.
No, entirely political. Does not matter for the legal at all.
Right. Legally, I don't think it makes any difference.
No, not at all.
Right.
But it's kind of weird. There was an exchange just as we were like getting ready to sign on for the podcast today, where I'm getting this from the Twitter summary, so the facts may be slightly muddled, where actually Pecker was testifying about that specific case, and for some reason the prosecution did not want him to talk about whether the results of the polygraph that were administered to that individual, which was kind of weird. I'm wondering if that was a little bit of a flub about not wanting to get into the veracity of these sorts of claims that might end up looking kind of strange. I don't know. It struck me as a strange exchange in reading this account of the direct.
Well, polygraphs are useless anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Exactly.
Fair enough.
Well, let us hop on the Acela from the Moynihan Train Hall and take it down to our nation's capital at Washington, D.C., where...
Saving a whole 40 minutes off the regional.
Exactly.
For like $500 more.
As we speak, I believe the Senate is in the process of or is about to vote to move forward, drumroll please, ladies and gentlemen, aid to Ukraine and a whole bunch of other things, some of which we will even talk about. So this is, I believe, a $95 billion aid package in total. That aid is split between Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel. And I have actually lost count of how many months we have been fighting about this. But suffice to say, it's been a while. Ukraine is in pretty dire straits. I think they are probably very, very happy to have this headed to them. And according to the Pentagon, they are basically ready to go to ship this aid whenever Biden signs the legislation. So there is of course, a congressional procedure drama backstory here about how Speaker of the House Mike Johnson ended up changing his mind and how Democrats supported him. But first off, I think there's actually been kind of a dearth of coverage about what is in this legislation and how it compares to past proposals. So, Scott, what is in the bill? And in terms of, you know, everything Ukraine could have wanted to a pittance, where does it kind of fall on that spectrum?
Sure. It's worth noting there's two different bills. There's an Appropriations Act that has all this assistance amount. And then there was this related bill that passed on somewhat marginally substantially more favorable terms, like 40 more votes, that had a lot of the related measures, including the TikTok measure we're going to talk about as our third topic in a second, along with other measures regarding Russian asset seizure, regarding a lot of sanctions measures and things like that. And they passed more or less in tandem with each other, but are separate pieces of legislation. You know, the package is substantially what we've seen has been on the table for a while. You know, I think it gets close to hitting what the Biden administration has been realistically pushing for recently, but with a couple of important caveats on the Ukrainian assistance front. You know, we're seeing numbers about $60 billion of Ukrainian-related assistance. A lot of that assistance goes to the United States government, actually like the lion's share of it, or not a lion's share, something like $20 billion of it plus goes to actually replenishing U.S. stocks that are transferred to Ukraine. But that does make it easier to transfer other stocks to Ukraine of existing U.S. armaments and supplies. A lot of it goes to services regarding operations in relation to Ukraine. That can be training missions. It can be staffing missions. It can be a lot of things that benefit Ukraine directly. Some of it is about like protecting U.S. embassies in Europe and deploying troops to Finland and Poland and other places where U.S. troops have deployed. I believe they deployed to Poland. I could be wrong on that. Then we see a big chunk of funds going directly to Ukraine, to the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative. That's the kind of like main vehicle for support in Ukraine. The one important caveat to all this on the funding front for Ukraine has been the idea that this is being structured kind of as loans. It's not quite that express, but essentially it says you the government should be negotiating and makes the government responsible for negotiating with Ukraine about some mechanism to repay these sorts of measures. They're framing them as a debt for most of the assistance here, as well as kind of rollover funds that are still carried over from prior legislation. That funding has a mechanism in place where essentially the president can forgive half of the debt accumulated shortly after the election this coming year. So presumably Biden is going to do that no matter what. And then the future president can do it in 2026, if I recall. I can't remember the exact date. So like 2 years down the road, whoever is the president after this next election will be in a position to potentially forgive the other half of it. Even in both cases, the Congress has the opportunity to kind of try and pass a joint resolution to supersede that through expedited procedures, something very close to my heart, Molly Reynolds' heart, our colleague here, which we love talking about expedited procedures, but I won't bore you with it today. Long story short, Congress could vote on it, but it's a joint resolution. The president would still get to veto it. So it leaves the president pretty solidly in the driver's seat, unless, you know, you can get 2/3 of both chambers to override a veto by him and pass this joint resolution. So all that's to say, it gets Ukraine a substantial amount of assistance. That is, I think, projected the time frame most of the assistance is through September next year. So, you know, through the election season, we're not going to have another debate about this. It's kind of on the table. You also have the Russian asset seizure provision. This is a provision that's in place that is framed as the House version, because, of course, it's a House package. I went through and read it more carefully after initially reading it and thinking, oh, they passed the House version. That's not going to fly very easily in the Senate, which passed a very different version. The version that was actually in the law looks a lot like the Senate version. It basically took most of the Senate's edits on board, a lot of which I had argued for in a piece on Lawfare a few months ago when it was being debated. And it looks like the Senate version. It walks and talks like the Senate version, even though it looks, in some of its vernacular and structure, more like the original House version. That essentially means $5 billion in potentially Russian sovereign assets may be seized by the Biden administration or its successor sometime in the near future, but contingent on some degree of international coordination and cooperation. And also, who knows what is actually going to come to that? There's a lot of policy and legal reasons why there might be difficulties in doing that. And $5 billion is not a huge sum of money. The real debate is the $200+ billion that's frozen in Europe. And so the Biden administration is going to have to focus on a plan that gets them on board with transferring anything if this is going to be a trajectory changing amount of assistance to Ukraine. So I don't think that the process on that is entirely done yet. Outside the Ukraine context, a lot of assistance for Israel, Taiwan and Taiwan-related assistance. We saw a lot of measures about new sanctions on Iran arising out of the post-October 7th violence, a whole range of new sanctions regarding different aspects of Iranian behavior, all sorts of other kind of collateral provisions in addition to the TikTok ban provision we're going to talk about in a little bit. You know, some of the more interesting ones that really relate to Gaza and Gaza assistance, among the other things we've seen, is a ban on support to UNRWA, which was a pretty controversial provision among other people by like even legislators that are usually pretty pro-Israel and pretty hard on UNRWA because they're worried there's just no other vehicle for getting assistance to Gaza. But people have known this provision was on the trajectory for a while, and they found ways to hopefully are working on ways to work around it. So it's a dramatic piece. It's one of the more dramatic pieces of foreign assistance provisions we've seen in a long time because we had this logjam for so long that so many measures built up behind it. And it was finally the kind of accumulated pressure of that that drove this procedural compromise that allowed this to get through with overwhelming numbers and substantial bipartisan support, particularly the authorization, not the appropriations bill. So it's interesting. I don't think it's a sign of things to come. I think this is a one-time measure, the one time we're going to see this happen, at least before the end of this election. But it does kind of, I think, signal a little bit of a shift in incentives, particularly as Mike Johnson is sitting in the speaker's chair and thinking about how to approach certain major, major questions like this he faces opposition from a narrow part of his party on.
So I think all that's true and interesting. The thing that, you know, I find in addition really interesting, which is not necessarily the foreign policy piece of this, but the kind of procedures of how this went. So in addition to loving expedited procedures, we also at Lawfare love rule packages. And again, I mean, I really wish Molly was here to nerd out on this with us. But, you know, I think one thing that's interesting is the fact that, you know, breaking a lot of precedent, the reason this got on the floor is because the Democrats or a bunch of Democrats went over to the Republican side to sign on to the package of rules, right, that has to be signed, has to be sort of agreed to by the House before the bill can come for debate and a vote. And this is, again, in contrast to longstanding policy or longstanding precedent where, you know, the majority party, everyone in that votes for the rules, even people that don't want to vote for the bill itself, and then everyone in the minority party votes against the rules, even the people that want to vote for the bill ultimately. And what I'm curious about is whether or not this is going to be durable, you know, or whether or not this might presage a or might give us a preview of how Mike Johnson is going to deal with his, I think it's like one person majority at this point in the House. I mean, something incredibly, incredibly thin. And whether that might actually be a good thing. There's no reason why you can't have folks in the minority party agree to the rules package, especially if they want the bill to pass. And, you know, maybe Mike, I mean, I didn't think 2 months ago, whenever Mike Johnson became speaker, that he was going to become a shining beacon of bipartisanship. But is that possible?
So, I mean, look, this is the way the legislature is supposed to function in a kind of idealized manner, right? Like, if you have institutional interest, the idea is that you work for to get a majority vote. The Constitution says the House works on a majority basis. And I think the basic idea, particularly before we had party systems, was that a majority means a majority of the legislators. It doesn't mean a majority of the majority, which has been the operational rule really since the late 1990s, early 2000s. I can't remember when the so-called Hastert rule kind of got brought put into play. You know, that has been a result of increasing political polarization and a rise of the parties as the dominant organizing structure in particularly the House of Representatives, more so than the committee structure, which used to dominate, you know, up through the 1960s and really into the Watergate era as a replacement in a lot of ways for institutional interests. Like a lot of legal scholars have written about how partisanship has kind of supplanted the and kind of spoiled the conventional conception of the separation of powers. I think overstating the case a little bit in some cases, but like it's still true. Like Congress is much less effective in representing institutional interests because there's such a cross-cutting wind of partisan interests. And this is a return of that institutional interest in a way, and the kind of like idea of a conventional majority that is ideologically in, more towards the middle. The real question, so in that case, I think it is a shot across about to the far kind of extreme elements of really either party, but primarily the Republican Party, because they're the ones who's operationalized in this way. And, you know, the real question now is what happens with Mike Johnson's speaker challenge? You know, where does that go? It seems like he stands a better chance to survive and might be open to Democratic support, and Democrats might be open to supporting them. The political scenario that allow that to happen, I suspect, is limited to this set of facts in this circumstance and is a product of the 9 to 10 months of like completely tortuous debate we've had over this legislative package. And so I don't think it's going to recur again in the immediate future. But this is a big like gap in the armor for the Hastert rule. Like this really does say, no, there are limits to the majority of the majority concept. And you, extreme minority, if you abuse it, we've got another avenue here. And yeah, partisanship is a real thing, but there are circumstances where we're willing to step beyond that. And the other possibility here, which I think is real and particularly true on foreign affairs, is that we're just seeing a partisan realignment. Like political partisan parties doesn't really like line up with foreign affairs views the way it does other issues or the way it used to maybe like 10, 15, 20 years ago. Like both parties have people of pretty divergent foreign policy views in a lot of senses. And particularly in the foreign policy and national security context, maybe that says that's an area where the majority rule is particularly ill-suited. Instead, you need to have this cross-cutting more majority of the whole body view because you just have too many bifurcated interests. There's not enough consensus within each potential partisan majority to have that sort of rule.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is also going to depend on whether Johnson pulls through, right? Because Marjorie Taylor Greene, I'm not actually sure of the status on the motion to vacate. Like, she threatened to introduce it, but hasn't yet introduced it. This is why we need Molly again. But, you know, there has been this threat looming over him that if he moved forward on Ukraine aid, that his caucus would boot him. And so far that hasn't happened. My impression is that some of that may be that there is pressure on Green from other factions, particularly among evangelical politics, to basically let Mike Johnson go on this one. But, you know, if he gets kicked out, then I think, I don't know, Speaker Hakeem Jeffries, like, where are we in that circumstance? It feels very uncertain.
Well, you can't have a Speaker Hakeem Jeffries because you're not going to get a single Republican to vote for him, right? I mean, it's going to be Speaker Mike Johnson with, like, some token. Because Hakeem Jeffries is going to vote for Mike Johnson in some power-sharing agreement. And Molly's head will well and truly explode.
I mean, that's the real question, is like, how much leverage does this actually give Democrats? Like, right? Like, and that depends on how much of a threat this is to Mike Johnson, how far Mike Johnson is willing to go. The point Molly really made, I think, in the conversation with you guys, was that, like, Kevin McCarthy really screwed himself over just because he pissed off Democrats and Republicans so much. No one was willing to cross the aisle to back him up. And that Johnson's just not in that position, at least not yet. Like, he is, despite being deeply conservative, seems to be a straight shooter, at least in these, you know, across the aisle negotiations. Although, query whether that's actually true, because he's done a lot of flip-flopping on his own legislative positions. But, you know, that's inevitable in that sort of role in this sort of moment. The question is, like, could Democrats extract other concessions from him? And I kind of suspect no. Like, I think this is the concession, a broadly bipartisan support measure, which, by the way, had a lot of throwaways to, like, more to the Republican side than Democratic side, like the loan structure, the UNRWA payment bar, the sheer scale of assistance to Israel compared to humanitarian assistance that is expected to go to Gaza. Like, those are all demands of the Republican caucus, and they got through. You know, Democrats really wanted this. That's the only reason this worked. And they were willing to give a lot away on the legislature. And in some ways, supporting Johnson will be the ultimate giveaway. Like I said, I think it's notable. It's a breaking of this strong norm, and a sign, I think, particularly that norm might be particularly problematic in this policy area. But I don't think it reflects a fundamental change in the dynamics that have been driving it. Well, let's take for our third topic the opportunity to zoom in onto one of the most talked about provisions by us in particular, but also by many other people.
And the youth in particular.
By the youths, the youths out there in America. Talking about the TikTok ban bill. This is a bill that this particular iteration of was a product of the Select Committee on China. That's not its formal name. I can't remember the full formal name. But essentially, the Select Committee that Representative Mike Gallagher had been chairing before his departure from the House. That, I think, was actually a pretty substantive, serious body that had pretty heavy, serious Democratic and Republican participation, and came up with a lot of legislative proposals, which, frankly, they're still in the process of rolling out despite Gallagher's departure or pending departure. I can't remember whether he's left or not yet, but he's leaving any day now if he hasn't already. And this is kind of like one of the big ones that really got a lot of pickup. Prior proposals have been introduced about different type of TikTok bans, but this particular iteration and structure has that set of origins and came in for that reason with a fair amount of bipartisan heft. And essentially what it would do, as I understand it, is say, once this is enacted, you have 1 year for ByteDance, the owner of TikTok, which is suspected of being too subject to Chinese government control because it has what is called a state-owned enterprise, has a golden share, meaning a minority stake that nonetheless gives its majority control rights around a certain nest of issues in this company under Chinese law, meaning there's a good amount of government Chinese influence, or at least potential influence, when they want to wield it. They will give that company 1 year to divest from U.S. operations TikTok. And if they don't divest, it's going to be banned after that. Alan, you've done a lot of thinking. You wrote a really, really useful piece with kind of five thoughts on the legal questions around this ban. Talk to us about it, both from the legal and the policy perspective. Why are people been pushing for this fix? And then we know this is going to be subject to litigation, right? We saw TikTok actively litigate when they faced similar administrative measures under the Trump administration, very successfully beating them back in court. Is that what's going to happen again here? Or is there a reason to think this might have a little bit more legal path forward?
Yeah, no, there's a lot to talk about. And you're right. This is definitely going to be legally challenged, as it should, because this is a very you know, this is a bill that I'll put on the table, I think is ultimately a good bill. And, you know, if I were in Congress, I would vote to support it. But it's not a straightforward bill, and it raises some very tricky issues, and they should 100% be litigated. And, you know, we're, again, recording this on Tuesday. I think the Senate may literally, as we speak, be voting on cloture for something. So, like, it may very well be that by Thursday, this bill is, you know, this bill has passed the Senate. The president has signed it. And, like, on Monday, there's a lawsuit in the DC circuit, which is where the bill actually requires lawsuits to go in the first instance. So this could be extremely fast tracked. And obviously we'll cover that litigation and keep talking about it. So, you know, the reason this bill is being passed is, it's hard to say why any bill is passed, right? And the political stars align, and, you know, this is a quote unquote anti-China bill. And that's like one of the very few things that anyone in Congress can get behind. But I think we should try to take the bill seriously because, as you pointed out, Scott, it came out of a committee that was, I think, quite serious, right? And I think is a committee that's sort of been one of the more impressive things that, frankly, Congress has done lately, that sort of Select Committee on China, or whatever its official name was. And there are two main concerns with respect to the TikTok bill, in particular with respect to TikTok being controlled by ByteDance, being controlled by the Chinese government. The first concern is a concern, and this is what you heard about a lot, I think, initially when this bill was being pushed through, which was the data privacy concern. Obviously, TikTok collects a massive amount of information on the 140 or however many million American users. We know that China wants information on Americans. We know that they can use that information on Americans. Scott, I don't know about you, but when I was in the Department of Justice, in the National Security Division, I became the proud owner of at least two, maybe more free lifetime credit monitoring services. Scott's shaking his head, it sounds like, as well, because your and mine and, OPM classified information records, the classified application records were stolen by the Chinese, right? Good for them. You know, they did a good job in 2013, 2014.
And since they know my birthday, they know all my passwords too. It's a real bitch of a situation.
Excellent. Well, you know, it's better than mine, which is just password, obviously. That's kind of the Chinese concern. Or that's concern about China and data privacy. Now, it turns out, I think, that concern is actually not a good one to defend the TikTok bill, because there are actually lots of ways for the Chinese government to get data on Americans. For example, they can hack it, but they can also just buy it. We in America, kind of unique among developed nations, do not have any sort of comprehensive federal data privacy law, which means that there are these third-party data brokers that have massive amounts of information on us that they can sell to whoever they want. And so, you know, when you think about a law like that and you ask, even if the interest is a compelling one that the government has, and data privacy of Americans is obviously compelling, you might say, well, how much, like, on the margin does the law actually accomplish the objective? And I think with data privacy, it doesn't accomplish it so much as to justify what really is a pretty potentially substantial First Amendment problem, which is shutting down a speech platform for 100 million Americans. So I think, you know, we should really focus on, and I think increasingly the legislative conversation has focused on, which I appreciate, the second justification for the bill. And this is, I think, the good one, which is you don't want a foreign adversary to have control over the information ecosystem for 130, 40, 50 million Americans, especially a lot of young people who get a massive amount of their information, not just cute cat videos and new dance moves, but news from TikTok. And I think that is ultimately going to be sort of the policy concern. And, you know, I think this is from Matt Iglesias, who had a good piece on this, I think, a month ago or 2 months ago. And the analogy he drew, and I think it's a pretty good analogy, is like, if the Soviet government wanted to buy a stake in CBS in 1960, like, no, we wouldn't have let them do it. And that wouldn't have been controversial then to not let them do it. And it shouldn't be that controversial.
Well, they
now
wouldn't have wanted a stake.
They wouldn't have wanted a stake. Fair enough. And I think that is actually reasonably compelling, frankly. And, you know, we can talk about the First Amendment issues. But I think that's the main concern. And, you know, given everything we know about the Chinese government's prickliness with respect to how it is portrayed abroad, and also its willingness to be just extremely heavy-handed in shaping the narrative, and its willingness to control its private companies quite ruthlessly, and that, you know, the TikTok ByteDance relationship, and there's been some good reporting on this recently, has frankly always been a bit closer than I think TikTok wants to admit. I think that creates a real baseline concern. Now, look, First Amendment law is always very complicated. At the end of the day, it's always some sort of balancing test, and you can have these endless debates about what level of scrutiny should apply. Should it be strict scrutiny, or intermediate plus scrutiny? I mean, a lot of your articles are written about, you know, the 73 levels of this. Ultimately, it's a balancing test, and it's very hard to predict. It's very hard to predict, especially in sui generis cases like this, where we haven't really seen anything like it. It's especially hard to predict when you have national security concerns. So ultimately, I think this is going to come down to what our 9 super legislators in the Supreme Court think from just sort of an open-ended balancing test. I tend to think that this will go to the Supreme Court, as it should. I tend to think the Supreme Court will uphold the law. I think it's not going to be that close, actually. I'm going to say 7-2, and I think they're going to pick up at least one liberal justice. I wouldn't be surprised if Justice Kagan supports this law. I mean, I'm just putting a guess there because it's fun, but we can revisit this in a year and a half, right, and see how accurate my guess was. But I do want to say, and again, as someone who thinks this law is fundamentally a good idea and thinks the First Amendment issues are surmountable, it's not a slam dunk by any means. And there are plenty of law professors out there and legal scholars who think that the First Amendment issues are more serious, and I totally respect that view. This is tricky because, you know, the stakes, honestly, on both sides are so high.
So despite my joke, I actually do think the Soviet comparison is telling, but perhaps in the opposite direction than you've suggested. And what I mean by that is that, so I'd recommend Thomas Ridd's amazing book, Active Measures, which is about the history of Soviet influence operations and American counter-influence operations over the course of the 20th century. And it actually is true that, you know, the Soviets did a fair amount of sort of seeding and funding friendly news operations or outlets that they thought would in some way, you know, give a boost to their perspective. And so did the US, right? And the problem with that kind of technique is that it's ultimately undermining. It leads to a huge amount of distrust. I think there's a reason why when the US tries to do sort of underhanded things like that today, there is a significant outcry. And the reason why I bring that up is not because that's comparable to a TikTok ban, because sort of covert actions, not in the legal sense, but not, you know, not above board, are of a very different character than saying straight up, you can't use this app unless there's a divestment. But I do think that there's a similarity in terms of, you know, what it says about U.S. values, and particularly the value of the free flow of information and the open internet. And my worry is that in the same way that the sort of tit-for-tat CIA, KGB, haha, we've started a faux publication in your country, undermined either country's ability to sort of speak to the integrity of its own mission, that in this instance, an American limitation on access to TikTok on the grounds that it's controlled by the Chinese government will make it a lot easier for an authoritarian government or a government that is increasingly moving toward a sort of nationalist approach to internet governance, such as Modi's India, will help give them an excuse, because then you can point at the US and say, see, they're doing it too. And I worry that in the absence of a really, really good reason, which I don't think that we have yet seen, that this is just a step in the wrong direction, which doesn't mean that the concerns aren't real, right? Like, I don't want to downplay them, but I do just worry that this particular way of addressing them could potentially be giving away something very, very valuable, without giving much thought to what's being lost.
Well, and I really like that point, Quinta, and I actually would push it maybe even a little further to say, I actually think that's a pretty substantial reversal of what has been a pretty long-standing overt U.S. policy, even in like really comparable circumstances. Because I think what you said, Alan, about the idea that, you know, we wouldn't have let the Soviet Union own a stake of CBS, I'm not sure that's actually true. I mean, throughout the Cold War, a big part of like U.S. policy was to try and get foreign governments to open up. Like, we had Radio Free Europe and a variety of other media packages precisely so that we could try and exercise influence and get access and have a free market of ideas is a fairly idealistic sentiment. It was abused and used in certain ways, particularly when you had the kind of like covert influence operations and things like that. But I think there was a public idea, an idea that Congress really drove in, saying the free flow of ideas and information is generally good. And we've seen that idea extend through, to constraints on, for example, the use of economic sanctions through the Berman Amendment, right? Which was enacted in the very late Cold War, but reflected a similar sort of sentimentality, similar sort of idea, which is that we should be encouraging the free flow of ideas and the United States should be at the front of that. And that means living up to certain values and allowing these things to happen. Now, look, that whole ideology, that whole approach was maybe time-bound, right? And I think it's a double-edged sword in this situation. On the one hand, I think it reflects the reality that I think is underappreciated, which is that a lot of free speech when it comes to foreign policy is not constitutionally mandated. It is a product of 20th century legislative policy and executive branch policy, often in dialogue with it, but often legislatively driven, to be honest. Like, a lot of aid restrictions and other restrictions were the drivers of that. And so that means I think if you're foundationally right legally, Alan, like I do not see a lot of First Amendment barriers here. I think there's colorable questions that'll be addressed. I think particularly after Humanitarian Law Project and related cases, like in a situation like this, I have trouble seeing the courts having much of an issue with this on a legal basis. That said, like from a policy grounds, I think it's actually a pretty substantial reversal. It is part and parcel of a broader reversal we've seen away from laissez-faire liberalism and a lot of other environments, including the economic realm, right? Like we used to similarly fully embrace open trade, neoliberalism, try and get free markets out there to a substantial extent, not unlimited, substantial extent, during the Cold War and in other environments and after. And we've seen the government shift away from that dramatically, and often for very good reasons. This idea of strategic sectors that we need to keep foreign ownership out of. This is an extension of that logic into this kind of speech domain. But I wouldn't want to underscore the fact that I think this is a substantial departure and a reflection of a broader shift in how we think about U.S. engagement with the outside world, particularly around our two major strategic rivals, Russia and China.
So yes and no. So I want to flag here a piece, and we'll put a link in our show notes to a great Law Review article by Ganesh Sitaraman, who's at Vanderbilt. He wrote it a few years ago in the Stanford Law Review, and I forget the name. It's something about like foreign control of U.S. platforms. And he does a good historical deep dive into the surprisingly robust regime of limitations that U.S. law has ostensibly for 100 years imposed, in some cases longer, imposed on foreign control of platforms. He goes through a lot of different platforms there, transportation platforms, but he also talks about communications platforms. And so, in fact, the idea of foreign ownership restrictions on radio and telegraph and telephone licenses, these are pretty longstanding. Now, to the specific question about, could the Soviet Union have bought a stake in CBS in 1960? I don't know the actual answer to that question based on what the broadcast regime was at the time. But, honestly, even the FCC, which gives out these broadcast licenses because spectrum is limited, does take foreign ownership into account and has long thought this was relevant. So I'm not totally convinced that this is necessarily such a big shift. Now, what I do think this is a shift from is from a certain kind of open internet rhetoric that was very, very prevalent in the 1990s in particular, so during the Clinton administration. And to that, I would say two things. The first is, it is true that the United States has always and historically embraced the free flow of information. And I still think there's a way, and this is certainly how I think about it, like how I sleep at night, right, in terms of my thinking that this bill is ultimately a good idea, where I still think I can square this with my commitment, which I really do have, to the free flow of information, which is that this is not a ban on Chinese propaganda. And I think it's really important. Like, this is not a ban on the People's Daily, right? This is a ban on the potential covert effects of, flow through Chinese ownership on the algorithms that curate the information, kind of the epistemic universe of 100 million Americans. And so I think to say this is a limitation on the free flow of information is to kind of beg the interesting question, which is, do we think that a world in which the Chinese government can, in principle, influence the algorithmic curation of TikTok, is that in fact a world of free flow of information? That's the whole point. Now, you could say, well, but the knock-on effects will be such that on net, the world will become more impoverished from a information perspective. That's totally possible. I do want to emphasize, and you made this point, Scott, that's not a legal argument. And so it's really important that courts are not going to take that into account, right, when they decide whether this is lawful. And as to whether it's a policy argument, I'll recommend another book. This is from the kind of early 2000s, or I think 2008, by our very own Lawfare co-founder Jack Goldsmith, writing at the time with Tim Wu, who's now a well-known professor at Columbia Law School, a book called Who Controls the Internet? Illusions of a Borderless World. A really great kind of short book, really still super relevant. In a sense, like 15 years before its time, I think.
I will say, I reread it recently. It, boy, does it hold up.
Yeah, yeah. And I think when people, it didn't make as big of a splash, I think, when it was first written, because it was a lot grumpier, than I think the geopolitics of the time supported. But today you read and you're like,
grumpy? No.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But now you read it and you're like, wow, they really saw what was going to be, the end of this kind of open internet. I think that dream died some time ago. I've always been a little skeptical of the, you know, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin and Narendra Modi are just waiting for permission from the, like, they're going to do whatever they want. These are superpowers that control their own internet. So again, Quinta, while I don't disagree that on the margins it's going to give a little bit of rhetorical cover, I think in some sense that's not necessarily America's job to deal with. Like, we got to control our information space. And also, I just wouldn't overstate how much, like, everyone else is waiting to get permission to balkanize an already balkanized internet.
No, I mean, look, like, the Russia and China need no, you know, cover. I do think, I'm not sure if Modi cares anymore, but the reason why I pointed to India is because that is, you know, used to be a country that we referred to as the world's largest democracy. I don't know if Modi and the BJP care about maintaining the fig leaf of plausible deniability in terms of the way that they are rolling back on internet freedom, among other freedoms in India. But my thinking was more that for countries that are sort of in that middle space, looking for an excuse, that the US, which, like it or not, is an actor who has a lot of influence here, will sort of help potentially push things in a bad direction. I think you're totally right also that, like, yes, this is one manifestation of a much broader shift from sort of 90s techno-utopianism toward a vision of an online world that is much more explicitly governed by borders, which, as Who Controls the Internet points out, has always been the case. And I guess my response to that is not to disagree, but more to say, like, I don't think it has to be an on-off switch, right? Like, you can acknowledge that there has been a shift here and say, you know, like, yes, there has always been a component of state power in terms of who controls the internet. It's a great book title, folks. But that doesn't mean that now that we're shifting toward what I would argue is more of a recognition of the way that things have sort of been from the beginning, that you have to go all the way in one direction or another. I think you can take that state of affairs and say, okay, given this, given that, you know, I think you would agree, we still value the ability to have a free flow of information, what other equities do we want to consider here? What policies are best to kind of deal with that environment? And I just have not yet been convinced that this legislation is the best way to deal with that.
I think those are all great points, and just to sort of argue against myself for a second, because I really do think this is complicated. You know, one thing that's been missing from the conversation, and here I will flag another thing we'll drop in show notes, which is a wonderful piece written by Matt Perrault, who's at UNC and a, you know, friend of Lawfare, on whatever happened to this thing called Project Texas, which was this plan that TikTok is this very, very complicated plan that TikTok was going to sort of move a lot of its US operations into Oracle, the US company Oracle, that was going to have control over the algorithm, and there's going to be a review. And it was basically this whole way that TikTok was trying to prove to the government, in particular CFIUS, that it could be trusted without divestment. And one point that he makes, and I think he's a bigger fan of the plan than maybe I am, but a really good point that Matt makes, is that in this, throughout this legislative process, we haven't really heard about Project Texas. When it's come up as, hey, you don't have to pass this bill, there's Project Texas, the legislators, basically kind of ignore it and say, you know, that's just a marketing gimmick. That may be true, maybe false. But I do think one thing that is going to come up during the litigation, without question is what alternatives do the United States have to something like a divestment or ban bill? And so I do think we're going to see the return of going to have this relitigated metaphorically and in a sense literally, whether or not there were alternate avenues. So stay tuned to that.
Well, folks, that brings us to the end of our time together this week. But this would not be Rational Security if we did not bring you some object lessons to ponder over in the week to come. Alan, what do you have to share with us this week?
So I don't just watch television. I know those are all my object lessons are just television. So I have a book. I have a real book that I am really enjoying right now. It's called The Wizard and the Prophet. It's by Charles Mann, who's a wonderful kind of science ecology reporter. And this book is about two very important ecologists / scientists, William Voigt and Norman Borlaug, who I will say the University of Minnesota gets credit for, and talks about their kind of life story and their role in this big debate that we're still having over whether or not, in order to avoid catastrophe, humanity has to live within the limits of the world, right? This is the what man calls the prophet perspective, or whether science and technology can basically get us out of whatever problems, and that the future is one of more people and more abundance and more energy, which is what man calls the wizard view. I will say I am like a 100% wizard all the way. I hate anything that even smacks of degrowth.
We know your feelings about wizards, Alan. We've covered this before on the podcast.
Oh, we have talked about wizards. Yeah, because I both prefer wizards to prophets and wizards to –
sexy warriors, I think.
Werewolves?
Well, it's vampires.
Wizards versus werewolves.
But then you thought of vampires were wizards for some reason.
Vampires are dark wizards.
This is our holiday episode. We got it. 3 years ago, 2 years ago. Check it out, folks. Dig into those archives.
It's a really, really good book. So you should all read it. It's from a couple of years ago, but it's still super relevant and a great read. And long live wizards.
Quinta, what do you have?
Is the Wizards a sports ball? Isn't there a sports ball team?
In Washington, D.C., the Washington Wizards.
Okay. Basketball.
I will say I went to a Wizards game once because the Warriors were playing and I was with someone who was a big Warriors fan. And I swear to God, every single person in the stadium was a Warriors fan.
The Wizards have been on a rough run for most of their existence, unfortunately.
It was pretty brutal.
It's like Gilbert Arena's days. That's all
right. R.I.P. What do you have for us?
they'll have their moment. They'll have every other DC sports team has slowly come back from the ashes. So they'll have their moment. But until then, what do you have for us this week, Quinta?
Yes, well, I have already spoiled my object lesson, which is the documentary Stormy, which you can watch on Peacock, yet another streaming service. I don't think it is a perfect documentary. There are a lot of loose threads that I think I kind of wish it had pulled on a little bit more in terms of exploring some of the context for her early interactions with Donald Trump and how it was that she first came to ask him for money to not speak about her story publicly. But overall, I found it a really compelling and pretty brutal, honestly, depiction of what this has been like for her and how it, I think at one point she says that it ruined her life or it ruined her family. It led to her and her husband divorcing. It led to a lot of time away from her young daughter, which you can see in the film is clearly extremely painful for her. And, you know, one of the things about Trump scandals is that they tend to kind of leave a lot of people behind them in the wreckage, whose lives are really materially damaged because of the attention and the ire that's directed toward them. And there's not often a focus on that because, you know, we've all moved on to the next scandal. But I found this really worth watching in how it sort of zeroes in on that and what that's like and kind of what it's like to be sort of drawn along behind Trump, sort of in his wake, so to speak, even as Daniels is very much sort of trying to fashion herself as, you know, a force of nature in and of herself and not someone who just sort of exists in Trump's shadow. So definitely recommend check it out.
My object lesson, I am, as mentioned, coming off of paternity leave, still on paternity leave, technically, other than for national security purposes. And that means I've been digging into a lot of activities that I appreciate I can do while holding an infant. And I've discovered a new one that's amazing. hosted at what may be a Mid-Atlantic institution. I'm not sure how farly distributed these are. So apologies that you don't have one in your town, but at the Alamo Draft House, if you've never been, lovely theater.
Amazing.
With bar food and drinks. I actually had never been before. I went, but in my local one, Tuesdays at midday, they have what are called sensory friendly shows, which are shows for people with young children or who have sensory issues where they're not comfortable going to movie theaters with usual circumstances, where I also feel like I'm not always comfortable or excited to go sit in the movie theater with really loud noises and bright noises. So I sympathize with that view as well. But you can go in, you can bring young kids. They turn the lights up, they turn the noise down, although not quite as down as far down as one might like. I had to complain about it, but that's okay. They did turn it down eventually. You can get food, you can get drink, do a meal day on Tuesdays. It was me, my wife, our 4-week old, and like 5 single dudes just hanging out watching Dune 2. It was great. Can't complain. Don't know why those guys weren't working, but that's fine. It's great.
What did your baby think of Dune 2?
It was a little intense. There was a little more extreme violence. Yes, exactly. But that's okay. You know, I don't think she had any idea what was going on. The black and white kind of chromatic scenes, you know, definitely did something for her.
Some interesting scenes to bring a 6-week-old to. Yes, I
forgot that part about what was happening. It was a great experience. So thank you, Alamo Draft House, for hosting these events. I hope you do more of them. Tuesdays midday. It doesn't normally work for me. So maybe spread them out some other times of the week. And for those who are on family leave or have other reasons to not go to movie theaters most of the time, definitely check them out. I thought it was great, and it's a great public service they're offering. So thank you, Alamo Draft House. We'll take free stuff. Send it our way. We can give you the mailing address. Let us know. Hats, it'd be great for the free blurb. Well, folks, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. But Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. So be sure to visit us at lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other podcast series. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RTLSecurity and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. Also, sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. Visit lawfaremedia.org/support for more details. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We were once again edited by the wonderful Jen Pacha. On behalf of my co-hosts, Alan and Quinta, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye!
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.